Hi, my name is Kim Metterson, co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Camden, and this is The Power of Attorney.
My guest today is one of my younger colleagues, both in terms of age and date of hire. So I'm excited to have him on board today for our conversation. So welcome, Adnan Zulfikar. Really happy to have you here today and looking forward to our conversation.
Delighted to be here and to join everybody today.
The way I like to start these podcasts is by asking people about their origin stories. There are so many things that a person could choose to do with their life, and you chose law school. I'll ignore the fact right now that you actually have multiple graduate degrees. We'll get into that. But ultimately, you decided to get a JD as well. So what was it, or what is it, about the law that was intriguing to you that brought you to law school eventually?
So, I guess it's a long story to some degree. I was a pre-med student in undergrad and doing a major in religion and anthropology. And at a certain point while during my undergraduate years, I mean, I sort of realized that while I enjoyed certain aspects of science and the study of science, that my passions really just lay elsewhere. Among other things, they lay in sort of philosophy, history, religion, these subjects. But I was also really active and involved in a lot of what you could call, I guess, social movement and activism at the time. There were some issues around police violence happening around the country, particularly with Amadou Diallo in New York. And then we had some incidents on our campus. I was at Emory University in Atlanta. We had some incidents around blackface and a few other things related to racial discrimination. And I was very active in then and sort of mobilizing and organizing people and along those lines. And I realized at a certain point that many of these things required me to have a sufficient knowledge of our political system as well as our legal system. And so that got me intrigued with regard to the law. And I took some classes as a senior in college in the law school on jurisprudence and one other law class, I believe. And that's kind of where it started. And then I sort of had this parallel interest throughout in sort of religious studies, but specifically around law in the context of religion. And, you know, there were very similar questions that were being asked in that context, historically even, or by jurists that were being asked by jurists here in the American context. And so in some respects, there was this constant kind of comparative thing going on. And I just, that eventually just led me to law school. I can give you more details as to the journey there, but I'll leave it at that and let you probe.
Got it. I have a feeling we'll come back to some of that. So I alluded to the fact that you are a person who, you know, some might call even overeducated, although I don't believe there's any such thing. So as you said, you have your BA from Emory, you have a master's from Georgetown, you have a JD from Penn, another master's from Penn, and a PhD from Penn. So I know that we talk a lot within law schools now about people who are doing interdisciplinary work and people who have degrees outside of the JD, which I think is really exciting. I'd love to hear you talk about, you know, how having training in these different disciplines is useful to you in terms of the work that you're interested in and in terms of the writing and scholarship that you're doing.
Part of the journey to sort of to get to where I am right now has meant acquiring sort of knowledge and information in a variety of arenas in order to kind of, for me, give me the best and well-rounded sort of scholarly approach that I can get reasonably. And so what these different fields have allowed me to do is just One, be able to explore a variety of different methodologies with regard to knowledge, right? So when I'm doing my PhD, my PhD was very text heavy. I was examining a lot of old legal texts from the Middle East and beyond in different languages, and having to engage in sort of this exercise of understanding hermeneutics, understanding language and understanding sort of how language functions in text, how it functions in society, etc. And so that gave me a great opportunity to kind of hone those skills. And then there was the fact that, you know, going to law school, you get this really well-rounded education and you get to really think as a lawyer. I think that one of the things I tell my students as well is, substantively, I'm not sure how much you are going to remember after your 3 years of law school. You remember some things here and there, and then the areas in which you practice, you will certainly remember and flourish in those particular areas of substantive law. But truly what you're learning in law school is the way to think like a lawyer, to look at one problem from multiple angles, multiple sides, and try to craft arguments in your favor. And so law school allowed me that. And then the other degrees, you know, they basically situated me in different contexts where I was looking at different types of problem sets. And I think all of that has allowed me to do comparative work really easily, almost as kind of second nature, to constantly challenge the status quo approach, because I realized that even that very idea, my education is not American-centric. And so I'm constantly looking at things from other perspectives. And I think that allows you to generate new ideas, brings new energy into old ideas. So I think that interdisciplinary education has been incredibly helpful for me. And I bring it into the classroom in a variety of ways.
Awesome. We're going to get back to the teaching issue, because I want to give you an opportunity to brag about how popular you are as a professor. But I also want to go back a little bit to what you were saying about the fact that your perspective is not just from this, you know, American or this US lens. And so part of that, I think, comes from the fact that you've had a really international background, that you've lived in lots of places, you've done some really amazing work. Would you mind talking a little bit about where you were raised, how you were raised, and how that has impacted the work that you're doing now, the things that are interesting to you, and the way that you think about the world and now the country that we're living in?
Yeah, I think that my background is an interesting one. I think I always describe myself to people as somewhat of a global nomad, where my childhood was one where we moved, not a ton, but moved for big chunks of time. And I think it's sort of captured by this one occasion, which at that point was not necessarily a happy occasion, but I was traveling back. I was in for my last 2 years of high school were in boarding school in New Hampshire, and I was traveling back to Malawi, Africa, in southern Africa, where my parents and family were based at the time. And I was going through Amsterdam, it was always, and this is well before 9/11. And, you know, it was always an interesting experience with sort of different levels of harassment. And I remember, you know, they did this kind of customs check before you get on the plane to Malawi. And the person who was interviewing me, you know, kind of took me aside, and I was grilled for about 45 minutes. And it sort of concluded with this really deep existential question where she said, you know, something like, how is it that you have an Arabic name, are an American citizen of Pakistani origin, but you live and reside in Malawi, Africa? And I remember just being like, Man, I feel like this is a question for my parents. They made these decisions, like, really isn't on me. And, you know, but it just, it kind of captured everything in that moment. So, you know, I my parents are of Punjabi, Pakistani origin, and that's always been a part of my identity, where we visited a lot as kids. But I was born in Virginia. I was born in Northern Virginia, and that's kind of where I was for the initial part of my life. When I was about 3 years old, we moved to Kenya, and I lived in Kenya for about 5 or 6 years. And then we moved back to Virginia for about 5 years or so. And then I think I was about 13 and we moved to Malawi, which is in Southern Africa, and a small country, had no idea, didn't know anything about it. And I ended up, you know, at first thought it was a joke when my father told me that's where we were going. And, you know, we ended up living there for a while. You know, my parents and family were there for almost 6 years. I left after about 3 to go to boarding school and then college. But in many respects, then I've then continued to kind of travel. I lived in Damascus for a year, lived in Pakistan for a year, and then have lived in a variety of places in the Middle East for 3-4 month stints, studying, researching, etc. And so in that respect, and you know, went to college in Atlanta, went to boarding school in New Hampshire, so sort of have a variety of American experiences as well. But I always tell people that, you know, I have an origin story for my family. My heart and soul in some respects still reside in Southern Africa, and kind of always will. And then, you know, I have my personality, I think, in many respects is very much defined by my Americanness, simply because of the time that I've spent here as well. So that's kind of my global background. So, you know, in the process, you pick up multiple languages, and I think the great thing about it is that you learn to speak to people in their register. So you know, people will always tell me, oh, your accent changes when you're in Malawi or in Pakistan or in with friends or with, you know, the code switching idea. That's not something that I was unfamiliar with, because my entire life was a lot of code switching, but it was just a way in which you sort of communicated with people in their register, that you came to them as opposed to wanting them to come to you. Mm-hmm. So I always joke that I sound very different in different places, and I came to embrace that.
Absolutely. I did want to talk about, you said, you know, that you bring this wealth and depth of international experience into your classroom. And I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, your experience as a law professor, particularly as a law professor of color at a time when we're having really important and sometimes difficult conversations about how we shape future lawyers, how we teach future lawyers, what we do in our classrooms in law school, and particularly the conversations that we do or don't have about race as part of the experience of being educated as a lawyer in the United States. So there are a few different pieces to that. So one piece of it, I think, is, you know, this question about how do you think your experience, your personal experience, your professional experience, your identity plays itself out in the classroom? And, you know, what are the things that you want to be able to convey to students that are part of how your experience potentially differs sometimes really greatly from their own?
You know, I think that these are all incredibly important questions for the current moment, and I think in general for any law school to constantly be thinking about, because I think in some respects we sort of, whether it's law school or elsewhere, we get comfortable in the patterns that we're in, and that oftentimes causes us to be left behind, you know, in terms of where, not so much where the trends are going, but just how knowledge and how society is growing in particular ways. And I think as a law school in particular, you have to have the ability to be nimble in that regard. In addition to that, though, I think that there are some incredibly important conversations that are happening now that, to be frank, were not happening when I was a law student, and I suspect were definitely not happening prior to that. And these are really around the issue of race and how race not only plays a role within the law school and the dynamics of the law school, but how race plays a larger role in the society in which these law students will enter. And for law school, how race plays a role in so many areas of the law that we teach or as students that we study. So I think from my perspective, look, you know, I'm a man of color who is someone who is of the Islamic faith. I'm Muslim, I'm devout. And in addition to that, I, you know, for me growing up here in the US or in college and elsewhere, you know, my circle of friends has also oftentimes had a very large component of people of color, primarily African-American, but then others from other backgrounds too. I had, you know, white friends, et cetera, as well. But that, you know, in terms of my community, these were major parts of it. So a lot of the experiences, a lot of the things that are happening right now in our society, you know, they've been in my purview and I guess on my radar for a long time, both because they reflect on my own personal experiences, you know, of being stopped by police, of having guns pulled on you, of other things along those lines by police officers in certain situations. And then also much more so for people who are very close to me and friends who are close to me who've gone through those things. And so, you know, some of the what we're witnessing and what's coming to the fore and now is sort of part of the news cycle in major ways. It's interesting to see because it's not certainly not new. It's just more well known. And it wasn't new back when I was in college. It was more well known at that time, you know, compared to the past. I spent my junior year of college spent the summer at the NAACP's Washington Bureau with the wonderful executive director, Hillary Shelton. He was just a great guy, booming voice. You should have him on your podcast just for that voice. But you know, I spent the summer, my main project over the summer was to do research on the instances of police brutality, not just sort of police violence, but or sort of discrimination, but actual sort of violence and brutality over the course of 5 years, looking through newspapers, you know, Google and all weren't that big then, looking through newspapers, etc., and create a report on that. And I spent the entire summer working on it, and it was just inexhaustible. Like there was so much that and groups that, you know, that probably aren't even around today, October 22nd Coalition and other groups that were reporting on these really crazy incidents of police violence over very like innocuous behavior and really sort of over the top sort of responses from law enforcement. And there was conversations around reform, all that. And so, you know, but this is all sort of a background that then I bring to the classroom and try to add texture to my discussions with students. At the same time, you know, I think it's really important for me to be somewhat removed as well, because I need them to have intelligent discussions amongst each other, to work these things out amongst each other without my kind of overwhelming presence there or the presence of my background. So occasionally I'll share a story or two, but I'll be very careful because I think in order to solve many of these issues, we have to have a real sort of substantive understanding of the different sides in it and not just be overwhelmed by one perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I should say for folks who are listening that your collection of courses includes criminal law, criminal procedure, investigations. I think next semester you're going to be teaching a class called Police, Prisons, and Protest, which is obviously super relevant to the time that we're living in now. And you also teach Islamic law. We will definitely get to that as well. And so I had an interesting conversation with a law professor quite recently who teaches constitutional law and who talked about how important he thinks it is to teach it with as sort of as straight as possible was kind of the way that he described it. So, you know, stripping back any sense of there being kind of, you know, politics or history or other sorts of controversial pieces of the puzzle. You know, what's interesting to me is we're having all of these conversations now about race within the law school curriculum. And one of the things that I have long said is you'll be pretty hard pressed to find any subject within the law school curriculum, particularly if you're teaching within an American context where race is not relevant to some degree. And you teach criminal law, which is a space where race is incredibly relevant. So I want to get a sense of how you balance what you were just saying to me before, which is, you know, you don't want to overwhelm students in the classroom, and you certainly don't want to overwhelm them with your sort of personal experience. But at the same time, criminal law, crim procedure, you know, these are really important places, I think, to have some of these conversations that students aren't having in other parts of the law school curriculum. So, you know, I think the challenge is, of course, you know, how do you balance those things out? How do you give students what they need to understand context, but also make sure that you're doing the things that are sort of, you know, the baseline things are expected when you're teaching criminal law or crim pro?
Yeah, so let me clarify. The first thing is I absolutely want to overwhelm students in the class, right? They should. They should be overwhelmed with all the factors that go into it. What I don't want to do is overwhelm them with my particular viewpoint or my story, right? Because I think that ends up, I'm just a larger than life presence in the class, just like any professor is. And so if I insert myself too much, I have to be careful that I don't sort of stymie the richness of the discussion. But I certainly think they should be overwhelmed. And if they're not going towards certain questions that I think they should be asking, I'll ask those questions. I am a big believer in the Socratic method and what some may call sort of cold call Socratic method. So I go, you know, I'll call on you and you won't know it. And I'm not going to tell you when you're going to be on call for my first year students. But I think that, you know, one of the things I've noticed, and this is beyond just law school, is that the discussion around race in the United States is such a tortured one. And by that, I mean that there is such resistance to have an open, honest counting of America's own racial history without people's sensitivities with regard to past wrongful behavior somehow, you know, coloring the sort of mystique of American kind of exceptionalism or the sort of the shining city on the hill. I think there's such concern that shining city on the hill is no longer going to be as shiny that this accounting doesn't take place. Whereas, you know, I remember I spent my first year summer of law school in South Africa, and like, I mean, they just had really frank discussions around race, and it was refreshing in many respects, and it was something which, you know, I sort of wish could happen a bit more in the U.S. because, you know, this advice around not bringing race into these discussions of law is frankly one that I got from many people with regard to teaching criminal law as well, that there's so much that has to be discussed that don't bring in race as well. But in that respect, yes, there's a lot that has to be discussed. But how can you not, in criminal procedure, it's impossible. The entire sort of history of, I would say, the Fourth Amendment relies or is reliant upon having a sense of racial history and sort of how these laws developed because there were such atrocious things that were happening to Black individuals who were suspected of crime. Likewise, within the criminal context, I just, you can have folks float in the theory, but you have to be able to at least give them some notion of kind of the racial dynamics that play out in criminal law as it exists in the world that they will enter if they go into criminal law as a career. And so I think all these things have to come up. Likewise, you know, other questions around gender, those should play in when we are having certain discussions within these topics as well. But race, I just don't think you can leave out. My sense is, if I'm completely honest, that for that same lack of comfort that exists in our society as a whole with regard to the discussion of race carries over as kind of a major obstacle for many people to bring race within the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it has less to do with the sort of claim that many will have that, there's too much to discuss, so we can't bring this other stuff, and much more to do with the fact that they just don't know how to talk about it intelligently. So, yeah. That is a criticism, certainly, but that's not something that cannot be resolved, right? It's just like you can spend a little bit of time and educate yourselves on these topics so that you can bring a more sophisticated discussion to your students. And again, like when I bring these topics up in my classroom, I try really hard to make sure that I'm also representing the other end of the spectrum so that it's not, I don't want a classroom where we're just preaching to the choir. I want a classroom that's going to intellectually investigate these ideas so that if you are, let's say, super progressive on these things, that you craft the strongest argument possible because you understand the other side of the, or the other sides of the argument as well.
Yeah. One of the things that I also think, though, is really critical is to deal with the folks who don't say, oh, well, there's so much that I can't incorporate it into the classroom, or I'm uncomfortable having conversations about race, and so I won't incorporate them into the classroom. But the folks who say it's not relevant, right? It's not an issue within the area that I teach. That's the thing that I think I find particularly challenging, given how much race permeates law in the United States. But the other piece of this, and this sort of goes back to the idea of being somebody who's an interdisciplinary scholar, and I'm thinking about this because I was listening to a podcast about mass incarceration, and the whole premise of this podcast is they sort of walk you through, you know, how did we get here, which I think is so important. And there are so many conversations that I think people miss out on because they're not willing to have the how did we get here conversation, right? So mass incarceration, we tell this very simple story about everything from, you know, the war on drugs to private prisons. But, you know, we can go back centuries and look at things like the rise of the myth of black criminality, or how when slavery ended and yet folks in the South still needed Black people to do work for low or no wages, that all of a sudden things started becoming criminalized that had not otherwise been criminalized because it was a way to force Black people into servitude in particular ways. So I guess, you know, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, are there ways in which part of what we're missing in law school is these other languages, these other lenses through which to look at how the law has been structured. So whether it's history or sociology or anthropology, you know, are those pieces of the puzzle that perhaps we're missing here that would help us do some of the work that we're talking about we want to do in law schools?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 100%. And look, as someone who considers himself a legal historian by my training, I mean, history is one of the things that is shockingly absent in law schools as a separate subject, right? I mean, every law class to some degree has history, right? Because we're looking at precedent, we're looking at sort of, you know, how the common law developed, how certain codes came into place, etc. But having a general history, like American legal history, or even history of what's going on at the moment where certain laws are coming about, etc., you know, it's just, it's off. You can go through 3 years of law school and really not have a sense of that. And I think that that is a major gap in legal education. After that, obviously, sociology and some of these other areas that are investigating topics of great relevance to legal subjects, you know, those definitely should be on our radar as well. But, you know, the challenge that comes up is that people who don't incorporate this into the their study or their teaching of the law, part of it is also just honestly like our broader education as a whole, right? So every few years, I find that, you know, the American public will get an education on some period within sort of American history as it relates to race that they didn't have before. And by that, I mean the general American public. It may be more familiar within the Black community, but won't be elsewhere. So, you know, right now, I would say it's the Tulsa massacres moment, right? Where that, the what happened with Black Wall Street and Tulsa, that has become something, because it's been injected into certain TV shows and other programs, that in the last, you know, 6 months or so, year, that's something which is more on the radar of a lot of, you know, mainstream culture. And part of that is really deeply sad that, you know, our general education system is not informing us enough about our racial history, that for some reason we are so, and you see this now with sort of the response to the 1619 Project and other things. And, you know, there are fair critiques to be made, but sort of the types of critiques that are this, you know, just, oh, this whole thing is, you know, shattering kind of the history as we understood it. I mean, that just should not be the posture of a nation that is secure in itself. And I think fundamentally, there's a deep-seated insecurity that we have that I think as a country you have to get over. And that carries over into our legal education, where we sort of don't want to insert race into a variety of subjects because we think about it as though we are inserting race into these subjects, as opposed to, hey, let me provide some historical context. It just so happens that our history is seeped in a discussion of race. Right. That doesn't mean that this has to be viewed as, oh, well, let's stop inserting race everywhere. No, let's give people a proper historical understanding of the law so that they can be better situated to A, practice it, and B, more importantly, improve it.
Right. Absolutely. And I was really struck by what you said. You know, obviously, that I teach South African constitutional law. And one of the things that is so powerful about traveling to South Africa and reading about and learning about post-apartheid South Africa is the sort of countrywide commitment, you know, everything from their constitution and to, you know, conversations that are happening on the street, but, you know, this real willingness to talk about race, to talk about apartheid, to talk about who they are now as a nation and who they want to be as a nation in very stark and honest terms. And it's something that, you know, I agree with you, we haven't quite learned to do, certainly not haven't learned to do as well here in the United States. So that brings me to my next question, though, which is, we are in this moment of thinking about our criminal justice system, of talking about pieces of that system in ways that we have not talked about in the mainstream. So talking about prison abolition, talking about defunding the police, talking about the importance of progressive prosecutors, right? All of these sorts of things, which is not to say people haven't been having these conversations, but they haven't been really mainstream conversations. Do you feel like we're in a moment of critical shift, you know, one sort of as a country, but also sort of institutionally, that we're that maybe we're finally crossing that line into being people who are ready to do the kind of work that needs to be done to change law schools, to change our criminal justice system, and to change the way we talk about and think about race in this country?
You know, it's hard to answer that affirmatively yes or affirmatively no, especially sort of if I put the historian cap on. I think that historically, the status quo always has a way of snapping things back. But what usually happens is that the status quo itself can get altered in the process. And so you may not get everything that the revolutionary wanted, but, you know, it sort of snaps closer to their position than it was previously. And I think that's kind of the moment that we're in. I mean, it's certainly a transformative moment when you look at the district attorney race in Philadelphia, one of the largest metropolitan cities in the United States. And you see that there was a discussion that the candidates for district attorney, for the most part, were jumping over themselves to advocate against mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. That they were going away from sort of the model that we generally know, which is the law and order DA who's going to make that argument, that they were taking these incredibly progressive positions and arguably pushed by one particular candidate who then got, you know, everybody alongside them to some degree, but you know, potentially exposing sort of sentiments that were more widely held, but people had been afraid to express. And that brings us to another point, which is that these type of changes in this type of thinking, whether it's criminal law, you know, police reform, abolition, progressive prosecutors, this is reliant upon the extent to which the public has adopted these views or is inclined to listen to these views or is leaning towards some of these views, right? So a DA cannot have a campaign built around addressing mass incarceration if the public is not on board, because they're not going to vote for him. Right. And so if you have a public which right now is more and more tuned in to some of these conversations, which the reason they're going mainstream is because they're more and more palatable to a larger segment of the public, then yeah, there's certainly ways in which you can see those shifts. So if we look at, for instance, the issue of, let's say, prison abolition first, you know, there is a strong conversation that has been going now, I would say, you know, starting sort of around the time of Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow, and maybe a little bit before that, where around that time it gained this kind of popular interest. And then you have the 13th come out, you have these documentaries, and it starts coming into the public view a lot more what this problem with mass incarceration is, and maybe, you know, what type of, we need no longer a scalpel, but we need a full-on sort of solution here. And so, you know, is that going to result in abolition of prisons? I that's probably a difficult proposition in the near term, but is it going to lead to prison reform in some serious ways? I think it could, and that'll depend a lot on what the public demands of its politicians. Likewise, with regard to policing, you know, the sort of seriousness now around this discussion of divesting or defunding the police. And you know, I think part of the messaging has, in my view, been a bit muddled, because the real question is along the lines of, hey, how do we reallocate some of this funding that we are going to an over-militarized police force in many cities and even small towns? How do we reallocate some of those funds for the type of services that communities oftentimes need, which don't require lethal weapons to come with it, or maybe require expertise that is usually beyond the training of any particular police officer. All of this is part of the discussion. And if that momentum continues, I certainly see changes on the way. If you look at, for instance, even something like a project that I'm working on these days, or research around the duty to intervene, where police officers, if they see a colleague engaging in wrongful behavior, that police officers have a duty to intervene. And I'm exploring and looking at sort of how different jurisdictions are considering this idea and sort of what proposals are out there. Well, you just saw that Carroll's law just passed up in Buffalo, which is related to a Black female police officer who intervened in a situation which was very similar to a George Floyd situation, intervened and basically saved the life of this individual and was subsequently fired from her position. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and has been fighting this battle. And eventually this law has now just been signed by the mayor there. So, you know, these things, they often take time, but if the momentum goes, if the public is engaged in serious ways, then I think you can bring about serious changes. The one thing I would say in this, and I said quite a lot on it already, but the one thing I would say on this is that, you know, that change can only come if it stretches beyond the tweet, right? Mm-hmm. So one of our major benefits is the power of the tweet, and one of our major obstacles is the way in which that kind of suppresses the type of activism needed to follow through and bring about the change. So if that doesn't happen, then I think there are a lot of prospects.
Absolutely. That conversation, which, by the way, was incredibly helpful and rich. So I appreciate your answer. I asked you a very big question, which meant that you should have taken as much space as you wanted to give me a very big answer. So that was really wonderful. But one of the pieces that kind of pops into my head based on some of the things that you just said is that we want and need to have these opportunities to really rethink the rules, rethink the structure, you know, rethink how we've created this system. And there's a piece of your CV that I find particularly fascinating. So I want to get you to talk about that now, which is that you were involved in a project in the Maldives to reform their criminal code. I would love for you to talk to us about that project, how you got involved, and you know what the work entailed.
Sure. So I got involved quite randomly, to be honest. There was a professor at the law school that I went to, and the professor was a professor of criminal law and happened to be an expert on codification. He put out sort of an ad for students who would be interested in working on a project of criminal codification and reform and criminal code drafting. And I had not been a student for criminal law, and you know, those were probably the students that he would give preference to. But the one thing I did have was I had a bit of a background at that stage already in Islamic law, and the Maldives was a Muslim country, and they were looking for ways in which to synthesize their sort of indigenous law, Islamic law, and their international legal commitments. And so that's initially how I got involved with it. And then, you know, just stayed. So it was sort of this kind of built around a class, but it was really, we were like a mini law firm where we would have these conversations with the Maldives and the team over there that was responsible for the legal advising. And then we'd do drafting and they'd send it back in red ink, etc. And it was, you know, a lot of students were there for a semester, maybe two semesters. I was there probably even, I would say, going on 2.5 years or so initially, even sort of for no credit, etc., just involved with it. And then, you know, traveled to the Maldives one time initially with the professor and another student to have kind of consultations with stakeholders over there. And then eventually, 8 years later, ended up leading the implementation project once it passed. I came in as the international legal consultant to help with the implementation. And yeah, the entire process was fascinating because, you know, we're dealing with many different things. You're dealing with a country that is obviously has many similarities to your own, but also has a different value system, a different cultural background, a different historical background. And so you have to be cognizant of that as you're trying to sort of synthesize these different parts of international law, indigenous law, Islamic law, etc., that they wanted. And then, you know, you sort of, there are various sensitivities that you had to be aware of, both on our side that we were sensitive about, but also on their side, which they were sensitive of us as Westerners being involved in this project. And to what extent were we going to try to leave an imprint of our own background? And I think it was, you know, to the professor's credit, he stamped some of those initial motivations that some students may have had to sort of bring about reform as it would look like for them, that, you know, to put in place a code that was more progressive than anything that existed in the United States, even, and sort of reflected their own personal values. And that was kind of stamped out pretty early. And then after that, it was just a matter of kind of, you know, working with the Maldivians on different parts of the code and then letting them know where, hey, look, this is where you may have a challenge bringing this in line with your international commitments. We're pointing it to you. Now it's up to you as, you know, a country, as a population to decide what route you want to pursue. So it was a great experience in sort of both code drafting, dealing with stakeholders in the country, with different parties. You know, when I went to go for implementation, it had been 8 years and there were a whole new set of sort of civil society actors who had interests. There were, you know, you had conservative elements, you had more liberal elements, you had all of that. And you're sort of trying to take a measure of everyone and seeing how you can reflect that in sort of the code's implementation and the training that comes with it. But it was fascinating. And, you know, it was interesting to sort of, in the initial days after implementation, sometimes getting a call at like, you know, 2 a.m. in the morning asking for an interpretation of a particular statute because there's a case before a judge that day, you know, which is just kind of a surreal thing, but is the reality of kind of jurisprudence develops over time. And in the initial period there, you know, there's need for some help with that from folks who did some of the drafting.
Absolutely. I love that. So there are two pieces that are popping into my head now, and we're not going to get a chance probably to talk about both of them extensively because we're running up on our time here. But I do want to put both of them on the table and see if we have a little time to talk about them. So one of them, I think, is about the role that legal scholars can play in the real world. So, you know, I think sometimes the critique that any academic gets is, you know, you're just sitting in your ivory tower and you're just academics talking to academics and there's nothing sort of concrete and useful about the work that you're doing. And, you know, what I love about what you were just describing to us is how you can take, you know, the theoretical things that we're working on and some of the scholarship that we work on, but that there are lots of law professors who are very much out in the world as well, that we're doing more than just talking to each other. If we're doing it right, I think we're doing more than just talking to each other. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about sort of the role of the law professor, you know, as sort of a public intellectual or sometimes even a policymaker. And then the second piece is, and this sort of goes back to what we were talking about a long time ago, which is that your other significant area of expertise is in Islamic law. And one of the things that we watched over the last just few weeks, we are recording this very soon after Amy Coney Barrett replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. And the idea of the potential clash between religious values and the secular values of our constitutional order was certainly a large part of the conversation around her and around her confirmation. And so because you do this work on Islamic law, I think another piece that's really interesting to think about and to talk about with you is how do we make sense of the ways in which there are all these different sort of codes and ways to codify law, whether it's religious or secular, and how do we make those things work together? And certainly, you know, how is the U.S. supposedly different and maybe not as different as we would like to believe in terms of the separation of church and state? So two really big questions. So, you know, you decide, do you want to just do one of them? Do you want to try to do both of them? You're totally your call, but both, I think I would love to hear your take on it.
Sure. I think I'll hit on both because they're both, I think, really important questions, not just for me, but I think in general. So the first question with regard to law professors and kind of their role in society, you know, I'll be honest with you. I chose becoming a law professor as opposed to going and being in a humanities department with my PhD, precisely because I felt as though it gave me an opportunity to be engaged in society. That type of engagement really wasn't looked upon favorably in humanities departments in the way in which in law schools, I don't think it counts towards your tenure file or anything necessarily, or if it does in minor ways. But I think that there, if it's not encouraged, it's at least not frowned upon. And mm-hmm. I think in a lot of places, it's also very much encouraged that you're involved in policy or a public intellectual. And so, you know, and it works out. As an example, I had talked earlier about this law in Buffalo that has come about. Well, part of the team that brought about that law were two Harvard Law professors, right, who have a team that they sort of work on these criminal law impact type of cases. And there are professors across the board in law schools that are doing this type of work. Some of them, you know, even in Philadelphia, who are really instrumental in a lot of major cases that come forward. You know, and from my end, obviously, my experience with the Maldives has allowed me to do that and continue to do that. And I'm still engaged with them in many ways about things that are happening there. And then in the city of Philadelphia, you know, it doesn't even, you can bring your expertise to other arenas that are related and sort of be part of a team. So I'm currently involved in a project in Philadelphia with a coalition of community folks who are community leaders, who are religious leaders, community organizers, who are people who are formerly incarcerated. And we are working with the DA's office to come up with a diversion program, which we are providing alternatives to sentencing and sort of other mentorship and opportunities for individuals in Philadelphia. So I've been involved in that project. And as law professors, you can bring a certain type of expertise, but you can also be sort of part of collaborations that make that coalition a lot stronger. So I think that's certainly something that should be there for all law professors who are interested in doing that. And I'm speaking here in just the criminal law realm. There are a variety of other areas where I also remain engaged globally and have been conflict resolution with regard to the Syrian crisis or other things as it relates to Yemen and working with international actors. And so, you know, I think those are all important things. In terms of the now Justice Barrett, who is on the Supreme Court, and the separation of religion and state and that entire discussion. And look, you know, there's a whole discussion which is separate, which is about kind of the problematic way in which the judicial nomination happened and sort of the norms that were really sort of violated in the process. And that's, you know, that's a much longer question, and I am not going to delve into that.
Sure.
But I think the religion question is an important one. I would have to say initially because, so there are going to be some unpopular things that I'll say here. Mm-hmm. First is that I think that liberals and progressives in the country have to reassess their sort of relationship with religion in this country. And by that, I mean that some of the initial responses to Justice Barrett being a religious person, before even any details started coming out of what that entailed and what views were there, was just hostile from the get, right? So that religion itself, as long as it's just identity, right? As long as you identify as religious, but you aren't actually religious, I think that there's a comfort zone for a lot of liberals. Mm. But liberals, like, we need to be more comfortable with just people who are religious.
Sure.
And so, and that, I have to say, like, it's not as much of a problem within, like, communities that I'm involved in Black community, etc. But in many other communities, it's a serious issue where there's just this deep discomfort with religion as a whole. And I think that that doesn't serve us particularly well. The separation of church and state is always interesting because I remember I worked for a senator right out of college, and I spent, you know, a couple years working for him. And I remember two things that always stuck out to me. The first was that every bill was signed in the year of our Lord. And I remember being like, wow, like, that's just, you know, I didn't know that. And, mm-hmm. and there, so I was like, okay, yeah, sure. There's separation of church and state, but we sign every bill in the year of our Lord. And then I would take the senator for Bible study in a room right across from the Senate chamber. Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, he was going to Bible study with a chaplain, the Senate chaplain, you know, on a regular basis, weekly or whatever else. Now, and I didn't have any issues with that, but I just thought that we should embrace the fact that, sure, like, yeah, religion is part of the discourse. It's part, you know, of what, it's part of American history. It's part of sort of our country's history. And there have been good parts of it and bad parts of it. And what we don't want is for one religion to, you know, obviously establishment clause, you know, end up kind of trumping any other religion out there, right? That's what we want to avoid. But it's not that we want to not allow people to be religious or even our politicians to be religious in that way. But if it begins to color their view or bring about discriminatory perspectives or cause them to bypass the law that we have on the books, the secular law we have on the books, for something else, then that becomes a problem, mm-hmm. right? And when, if we have evidence of that from a judge, then, you know, that's something that we have to hold that judge to account for. But I think that what we have to be careful about is having a presumption of bias simply because someone is religiously devout. I think that we have to be careful about, and we sort of run into many issues if that's a presumption we operate on. Now, I leave as a separate question as to whether Justice Barrett demonstrated in past opinions whether she was biased as a result of her religious views, etc. I haven't examined those. I don't know, you know, the nature of those, but I think for liberals and progressives, I found that some of the discussion around religion was deeply problematic and needed to be reassessed and just demonstrated an insecurity with religiosity, which I don't think it's the entire progressive camp, but there were too many of us who were in that boat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I don't wholly disagree with that at all, but, you know, I think that some of the challenge here is the years that lots of us have watched this sort of far right, you know, evangelical effort to infuse our constitutional system with these elements of religiosity, right? And so the challenge, of course, is being able to say, how do we identify that the decision that a particular judge or justice is making is reflective of religious tenets versus reflective of the law, right? As if those two things are distinct in such ways that we would always be able to discern what bucket a decision was coming out of.
Right.
right? I mean, so, you know, I'm Black, and I grew up in a household that was religious, certainly not as religious as some of the other Black folks I know, and even some of the other folks in my family. But, you know, I'm very comfortable with the idea of people who are religious and people who believe very deeply in God and go to church and all these other sorts of things. So it's not really a discomfort with that so much as it is a recognition that there is a wide swath of this country that thinks of this country as a Christian country, that thinks of this country as a place where laws emanate from the law of their God. Right. And so how do we reconcile that with what we think our system is supposed to be?
Right. And in fairness, a couple things. One is, you know, it's also that same religiosity, I think, that has been at the heart of many of the major changes that have happened. Right. So the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was a deeply religious man. And if you look within the civil rights movement, you had deeply religious people who use that same sort of moral voice, which maybe gets used in other ways, but use that towards kind of, you know, more positive changes within our system. But I think the question of a Christian nation here, I would say that, but partly the people who make that claim, you know, we have to contend with kind of our historical legacy in that many of the things that we had on the books have had on the books or are on the books were coming from this particular background of sort of devout Christians who were involved in the creation of law. And I think that the challenge for us as well is that law inherently is created through people infusing their values within a particular system in order to create laws that they want to be governed by. Mm-hmm. What happens in a society which is as heterogeneous as ours, right? Where not only do you have atheism or non-religious folks, but also religious folks of different stripes and different values, and they're all there trying to contribute. Now, part of the argument will be, well, there's got to be some kind of, you know, Rawlsian public reason type of thing that is behind, you know, the laws and that we're putting in place. But I think that, you know, there's value to sort of that thinking. But for a lot of the religious actors in society, it's very difficult for them to suppress the informing of their values by religion and then saying, hey, let's put that to the side and now think in this other way. It's going to infuse it no matter what. Mm-hmm. And we see that everywhere, right?
Sure.
And so the challenge for us is just if we're thinking about judges or even if we're thinking about politicians, to make sure that we hold them to account such that if something is overtly appearing to be discrimination on the basis of religion, that we hold them to account for that. Aside from that, if we have suspicions, etc., you know, is religion going to influence a judge's opinion? Yeah, of course. Just like any other ideology, if you're a socialist, a communist, if you're a progressive, whatever kind of belief system you have adopted that is informing your values, they're going to come into decision making, come into the types of laws you want to put out. We just want, I think, in a society, in a democracy, the goal is to try to make sure that we hold each other to account enough that one is not creating a supremacy over everything else, that you're allowing the heterogeneity of your society to maintain itself. But I think that on anything more than that, you are just going to get at most disingenuous actors who will, you know, say, yeah, religion has nothing to do with what I'm doing here. But in fact, it's infusing their values. It fuses their worldview. And so it's going to influence it in some way or the other. And that's just the challenge of living in as rich and diverse and multifaceted a society that we have. And it's never going to be perfect or utopic. Right. But the challenge of the current moment is that in order to do all that, in order to live in a heterogeneous society, there has to be things like decency and dignity and respect and honor and the sort of current politics, you know, and not to get too political, but, you know, the current moment and sort of the individual or individuals driving the current moment really cut against those core things that are necessary to maintain from many come one idea.
Well, I'm gonna leave it there. I feel like we could go back and forth on this last point for quite some time, and I've already stolen a bunch of your day. So thank you so much. It's always so great to talk to you. I miss running into you in the hallways and getting to catch up on things. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me today and to share your thoughts on a whole range of different issues. And, you know, time will tell what Justice Barrett is like on the court. She's going to get a chance to show us pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, we do have the one nice thing just for the listeners out there is, historically speaking, it's really oftentimes hard to predict how a judge is going to turn out on the basis of who appoints them. I mean, oftentimes, you know, they surprise us. So who knows? But, you know, I think to reiterate, the challenge there with her has been much more around the way it was done and the process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're going to end it there. And again, thank you. It was lovely talking to you. And maybe we'll have you on again and we can finish this last part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love it. And it was a pleasure being with you as well.
Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations, minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal small campus experience. Learn more by visiting law.rutgers.edu.